Welcome to Elmtown episode 10, everybody. Today we're going to be talking about Elm at companies and shipping it and having it in production and learning it and all those things that are involved in having a company and using Elm. And here I have with me Kevin Yank.
Hi there.
Kevin, did I pronounce your name correctly?
Yep, you got it in one.
Great. And Richard Feldman. I'm just going to assume, Richard, that I got your name right.
You did. Great job.
Okay, good. Those American names are pretty hard for me, but I pull it off sometimes. And we got some great sponsors this week. Same sponsors we had last week, but because we love them so much, we're going to talk through them again. Asterisk, number one, is an Elm and DevOps consultancy, and they're based in St. Louis. They do training, custom deployment, integration, and deployment for your front-end and your back-end apps. If you're stuck on where you want to go next with your Elm application, or you just need a hand getting started, go ahead and contact Brian Hicks at brian@aster.is. And next up, we have HumbleSpark. HumbleSpark is a development consultancy based in Chicago. They specialize in web and front-end. They provide practical experience and expertise in front-end development using modern tools, frameworks, and languages, including Elm. They also support the Elm community through investing time in open-source contribution, in screencasts, and other learning materials. Day One, the company that I work for, is our next sponsor. We make a beautiful journaling app for Mac and iOS coming soon to other platforms. I love Day One. I have many years of journal memories in it, and we have some pretty neat features coming down the pipe, including end-to-end encryption coming soon, hopefully, and that's something people have been wanting for a long time. So keep your eyes peeled if you're interested in that. And last but not least is Daily Drip, a training service that makes keeping up to date on programming skills easier. As you know, it takes time to find good resources to learn new things, and Daily Drip's already spent that time for you. They've got good resources for learning lined right up that you can go and consume. Once you sign up, pick your topic, Elixir, Elm, CSS, HTML, and you'll get emails every weekday with a short video or reading delivered right to your inbox. And these are kept short intentionally. They're short enough to be consumed in like 5 to 10 minutes. And the idea is here to give you a little bit of powerful learning every day so that you can advance forward without having to invest huge amounts of time watching people not make super great training videos. Anyway, we have a special coupon code just for Elmtown listeners. If you sign up with the coupon code Elmtown, all one word, lowercase, Elmtown, and then you'll save $9 on your first month, which means you can try out the Elm topic for free. And when you do sign up, don't forget to use the coupon code, because that'll show support for our podcast and make us happy and make Daily Drip happy too. Learning should be a daily occurrence, and Daily Drip can help you with that. Next, I want to have a section of thanks. I've never done this yet, I don't think, in audio, but huge thanks to Fergus Michael John. And here I am with the pronunciation thing again. But Fergus, I hope I said his last name correctly. Fergus edits our show every week, and he does it pro bono. He has some fantastic audio editing skills, and he does this as his contribution to the community. So that's a huge thanks to Fergus, and I really, really appreciate that, because he uses his talents in ways that that I can't, and it makes the show a lot better. That leads me actually to a note about audio quality. I've asked for feedback on the show, and the number one piece of feedback that I've received so far is that the content is fantastic, but the audio quality could use some help, especially with guests. So we've been making efforts in the last couple of shows to make sure that all the guests have good quality audio setups, some microphone with headphones so that we can reduce the background noise. And unfortunately, last week, everyone's audio was great but mine. Something had gone wacko with my mic. I know, right? My mic sounded horrible, as I was informed afterwards. So hopefully you were able to understand some of the things I said. Probably not necessary, though, because I probably didn't say anything worthwhile. But in any case, I apologize for the audio quality. Hopefully this is going to be the first show with all fantastic audio, or one of the first ones. So we're working on it. We've heard you, and we agree. We want to make amazing audio, too. So now that we've had this whole 5 minutes of just my voice, let's move over to having some other voices in here, too, and do some introductions. Kevin, you're new, so why don't you introduce yourself a little bit?
Well, hi there. I'm Kevin Yank. I work at a place called Culture Amp, and I'm based in Melbourne, Australia. Although you can probably tell from my accent, I'm originally from Canada. Culture Amp is a startup that's been in business since about 2014, if I have my facts straight. We have our head office in Melbourne, but offices in San Francisco, New York, and London as well. We like to call ourselves the world's most powerful employee feedback and analytics platform. So companies like Slack, Airbnb, Pinterest, and Etsy use us to survey their workforce and find out how they're feeling about their company, their job, and their place in it. And I'm leading a new team at CultureAmp that is building our second product, which is Effectiveness, which allows individuals in a company to survey themselves and their peers to collect feedback on their own development and effectiveness, which
that sounds awesome.
Some people might be familiar with as a 360 feedback model. We're basically building a product for that.
Yeah, that sounds cool. Great. I'd love to see that.
I've been a web developer professionally since 1997, but probably been dabbling with it for about as long as the web has been a thing. I spent 10 years at SitePoint.com, where a lot of people may know me from. I wrote and co-wrote a number of books on things like PHP, JavaScript, CSS. I co-hosted the SitePoint podcast for many years, but lately I made the move to CultureAmp in 2015, and that's where I am now.
That's great. How did you decide to make that move? What led you there?
After 10 years at a place like SitePoint, you kind of feel like you become part of the wallpaper. And it was just time for a change. I needed to stretch myself and do something scary. After a couple of years of kind of dabbling in startups that weren't getting any traction, I found out about CultureAmp. And it was a company that was new enough that it was still scary to join. But it had a mission that really appealed to me of improving the workplaces of the world and making the companies of the world better places for people to spend most of their lives in. And they had real customers, which made a big difference to me at the time as well. So I feel like I have the luxury of working at an exciting startup with real paying customers at the moment. And I couldn't ask for anything more than that.
That's fantastic. So you up and moved to Australia from Canada at that point.
I moved to Australia for SitePoint. It was the kind of the exciting thing I did when I graduated university. I had been to Australia before. I knew a few people there. And I thought, you know what? I've got a job offer down there. That sounds just risky enough to be exciting, but not so risky that I'm taking my life in my hands. I've been down in Australia for about 15 years now.
That's fantastic.
Very cool.
I was surprised when you joined the show. I thought I was going to hear some nice Australian accent going on there.
I'm sorry to disappoint. After all this time, even my Australian impression is pretty painful.
That's okay. I actually like Canadian too, so we're all good there. Thank you, Kevin. That's a great introduction. Richard, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Sure. So I'm Richard. I work at No Red Ink. We make grammar and writing software for English teachers. Students use our site to answer millions of questions per day. They've answered a total of over 2 billion since we started, which was in 2012.
That's a lot of answers.
It is, yeah. And it's just getting bigger all the time. We are hiring for Elm as well as other roles, full stack infrastructure, just hiring pretty much everything. And we're now up to about 80,000 lines of production Elm code. And that's also getting bigger and bigger all the time. So it's definitely the majority of our front end. And we just basically do everything in Elm to the extent possible. The more Elm, the better. And that's been fantastic. Happy to be here talking about it.
That's great. And I will introduce myself, even though you may probably know who I am already. I am Murphy Randall, and I work for Day One, and I already introduced them in the sponsors, but a journaling company, and I love it there. And I've been using Elm to produce our front-end web app right now, the front-end for our web app, I should say. That in combination with other technologies. So that's our story.
Murphy, I just want to jump in and say Day One is an app I bought several years ago, used for a little while, and then I didn't need it for what I was using it for anymore. And following being reminded of its existence through Elmtown, I've gotten back into my daily journaling habit. So I just wanted to say I'm a fan, and I can't wait to see what the web interface looks like.
I love that. I love that it was able to get you back into the habit again. It is hard to stay in the habit of journaling. But, you know, actually, I've noticed that since starting to work at Day One, I've started journaling more than just personal stories. I've started journaling instead, like, facts, you know, picking up, like, tweets and things, other areas of my life that I wasn't recording before. And that's been really helpful. Day One can do that too automatically to collect some of those things for you.
Yeah.
Pretty cool. And that's helpful to kind of build a picture of my life because I have a horrible memory. It's hard to remember where we are. So let's start out with the show topic, which is a little bit wide, but it has to do with companies and Elm. So like our companies, how did we start using Elm? What's it like to have it in production for those who do? And all the associated questions. So I'm going to ask Kevin and Richard to start out and tell the stories of how they got Elm started at their company. Let's have Kevin go first, because I think we may have heard your story a little bit, Richard, but I want to hear it too. Let's just have Kevin start out.
I'm looking forward to the update. CultureAmp has been around since about 2014. And at the time I joined, it had what would probably be the typical bootstrap startup or Series A startup tech stack on the front end that you would expect, which is jQuery spaghetti code. And at the time, there was widespread acknowledgement throughout the team that we needed a framework, something to provide healthy patterns in the code base on the front end. And what we chose at the time was what everyone was choosing at the time, which was React. We had a senior front-end developer who had experience with it before. He led the process of introducing it to the team, and we all began the fairly arduous process of upskilling on things like React, Webpack, Redux, and the list goes on. More recently, I started this new team at CultureAmp, and as the team lead, I'm kind of in control of the technology decisions within my team. And the initial team that I had was mainly back-end developers, or mainly developers with back-end experience. I myself have a lot of front-end experience, but the senior developer on my team had worked in Haskell for several years beforehand. And he came onto the team and said, look, I know we're doing this React thing, but I've been dabbling with Elm in my spare time, and I really think it's worth a look. And so what we did is we ran a little experiment. We picked a single page of the product that we were about to build, and we said, this will be our Elm experimentation page. And we started by building, you know, we've heard this story before of start with one component, a small rectangle in the middle of the screen that you can build with Elm. And if that goes well, expand out from there. We had the benefit that we were building a whole new product within the CultureAmp offering, so it was a bit green fields, which made, I think, the process a little bit easier. But nevertheless, we started from the middle and worked our way out. And to make a long story short, we really enjoyed the process. We really enjoyed what Elm brought to the table. It wasn't uniformly painless. We certainly had learnings on both sides of the table of pros and cons, but it so far at least has been beneficial enough that we have continued to build things, and we have even started to rebuild some things that we built in React in Elm. We are still a small team within a bigger company, and I think even if we are convinced within our own team, the question now is, what is the future of Elm at CultureAmp? Does it replace React and Redux? Does it have to replace React and Redux to be considered something that we keep investing in? And those are the questions that we're asking ourselves now where we're at.
And do you have answers to those things yet?
I'm looking forward to having the conversation today, because I know this is something, you know, we're asking ourselves questions around things like hiring for the future. We're a fast-growing startup, and we need to grow, and we need to attract developers. And I know this is something that Richard has spoken about before, about his experience at No Red Ink. I think, Richard, I last heard you speak about this in the Q&A panel at ElmConf, and I was really interested to hear that perspective, and I'd say we are, as a company, about to embark on that experiment here and see how it goes. On the one hand, I think within our team, we are uniformly convinced that Elm is better to work in than the complexity of the equivalent JavaScript stack. But if we can't attract developers, then that would be a problem that that might put the kibosh on the whole thing. I'm hoping we can attract developers, though.
I hope so, too. Just tell management that the type system makes up for 50% of the developers that you would hire.
Well, just this past week, I held a brownback session because we had done, Marcos, who was the developer on my team who introduced Elm to us, ran a brownback several months ago just to the entire development populace at the company and said, look, this is what Elm is, you know, the standard Elm 101 hour-long talk. And I came away excited enough from that to try it, But there were plenty of things along the road that we found that were unexpected, that were surprising to me, that I was eager to share. And at the same time, the developers and the rest of the company were really curious to hear how our experiment was going. So just this past week, I held a lunchtime brown bag session where we kind of went, you know, a few months in, here's what we've learned. And I would say the benefits of Elm were unexpected. Going in, Elm was advertised to me as no runtime errors. And, you know, as absolute a selling point as that seems to be, I think if you are invested in your JavaScript ecosystem, you've made your peace with your runtime errors. You kind of go, oh, they're not so bad. We can live with those. We fix all the really bad ones, and the rest are in our bug tracker. So that's not a killer feature, or it wasn't for me at the time. And the type system, I thought, would enable us to accelerate building new things. But that wasn't really my experience. Instead, what I found is things like the strong types of Elm really make you spend your time elsewhere. So rather than writing lots of unit tests, you are spending a lot of time thinking about your types. And to quote our guest Richard here, building states that cannot represent invalid states, making the impossible impossible. And that's where you spend all your time, which is nice, but I found that we didn't end up building features any faster, not new features from scratch. Where the big win was for me was when we then started changing our minds about things, or wanting to refactor, or you know, when an assumption was no longer valid and we needed to expand the scope of a part of the system. That's when it really clicked in. And that, to me, is where a dynamic language like JavaScript really leaves you up to your own devices. You know, you want to change what this button does, you're going to have to update four different files in your code base, and no one's going to help you remember all four of them except your own brain. Whereas with Elm, you've got the compiler there that, you know, you make the change that you want to exist, and then the compiler will lead you around your code base by the nose, telling you everything else you need to take care of to make that possible. And then when you're done, you can almost not believe it, that it, you're like, surely there's something else that needs doing. And the compiler says, no, I think you'll find you're finished. Go ahead and try it. And it works. That was the real killer for me. Other things that really benefited us, Elm format, I think, is not advertised enough.
Awesome.
At a company of our size, yeah. When I joined CultureAmp, we were six developers, and it was pretty easy to get us all in a room and have a little argument about a linter rule and then kind of walk away grumbling, but all on the same page. When you get to 20 and 30 developers, and by the end of this year, 50 and 60 developers, there's always going to be someone disagreeing with a previously made decision and raising that same, you know, linter rule for discussion on Slack, and everyone has to have the same argument again and all agree that there's no right answer, but we should probably just stick with what we've got. All of that wasted time just disappears with something like Elm format, where there is no linter because your code is formatted canonically as you write it.
And amazingly, it's not even just the social element that you save, but I have found it to be so beneficial while I'm writing with just me on the team, because I write sloppy code and it's way faster, and then I hit save and it's beautiful all of a sudden.
Or when you're a beginner in Elm, you write code that might not be right and you save it and nothing happens and you're like, okay, I got something wrong. But The moment you get it right and everything just clicks into format, you can do a little happy dance because your tool has told you you wrote code that makes sense.
I love that. I've also sort of started using it for like quasi keyboard shortcuts, where like I'll have a list with five things in it that are all on one line, and I'm like, oh, I want to make one of these longer. I want to turn this into a multi-line list.
Yeah.
And I know that Elm format has like two modes for lists, single line or multi-line. So I'll just put a line break somewhere in the middle of the list and hit save, and it's like, brrr, okay,
yeah, me too.
There
yeah.
you go, multi-line.
All the time.
Yeah, similarly, so when I've got a single case and I need to introduce a case statement to handle multiple cases, I don't have to take the 2 seconds it takes to indent all of my existing code. I can just insert a case statement at the top, and Elm format goes, oh, I'll indent all that for you.
Yep.
So once I got used to Elm format, I was dying in all the other languages, so I found format plugins for my SCSS and also my JavaScript and HIndent for Haskell, and now I'm just missing something for PureScript, and it's killing me.
Yeah. You know, it's weird, because now when I write code in other languages, it feels like the save button is broken.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I hit save, and I'm like, so make it nice. What do you... Ah, oh, by hand. What? It's like, because I've been programming for, like, over 2 decades now, and, like... It was always without any kind of formatter, and it's like so quickly that I've become like accustomed to this, and now it's just like a must-have. Like, it's, you know, like it's like a smartphone. Like, once you have it, you know, it's like really hard to remember what life was like before it.
Totally agree.
Yeah. The last thing that we found that was a real benefit that maybe I didn't think about going in was the reduction in complexity. We added to our stack React, Redux, Immutable.js, and I think we would have added a TypeScript or Flow, like a type system for JavaScript, if it weren't for just the crushing weight of the complexity of all of these tools and all of these layers and how you configure all of them in your Webpack config. And that stack that I just described is already at the point within CultureAmp that there is probably no one person who understands our entire tool chain from end to end. Whereas with Elm, you get one thing that you install with one command that provides all of the same benefits as that ecosystem. And again, for someone who is wedded to their JavaScript ecosystem, who takes pride in the fact that they understand it as well as they do, that's a hard argument to make. But coming out the other side of that journey, I really have to admit it is a huge benefit. And particularly as we added a junior or two to our team, getting a junior up to speed on Elm is night and day difference between getting their head around React, Redux, and whatever else you mix into your JavaScript soup. With JavaScript, you kind of just have to say, pick a small part of it, see if you can understand vanilla React, and then when you run into something you don't understand, call a senior, we'll pair with you, and eventually, by osmosis, you'll start to learn how it all fits together. But with Elm, it's a single coherent story, and I think that makes a huge difference too.
It's also a surprising benefit, I think, that like all of those pieces work well together, right? So like in JavaScript, it's not just that you're picking all these different libraries, but because each of these combinations of things is slightly different, there are always these edge cases where like the pieces don't quite fit together perfectly, or like they fit, but totally. They're not as ergonomic as they would be if it were all designed for the same ecosystem.
Yeah.
And that's like, it's hard to articulate like the kind of the difference there, but it's like in Elm, not only do you already have like immutability is built into the language, you don't have to get that from a library, but it's also that like all of the libraries that not only come with the language but the third party ones, none of them are like, are they immutable friendly? It's like, well, of course everything is. Like,
yeah,
that's the only game in town.
Yeah.
Right. And it's the same thing with side effects. It's the same thing with, you know, the stylistic conventions around like argument order of, you know, like what, which arguments go in which place. It's kind of like, oh, you make it pipeline friendly. You know, there's just like so many things that are just so consistent because of, you know, this cohesion of the ecosystem.
I also want to throw in the package manager, which is kind of this invisible, but also incredibly helpful tool. The package index lists all these packages, and if it's up there, you know that it's compatible with the latest version of Elm.
Yeah.
And like I've never pulled down an Elm project and gone to use it and been like, oh shoot, there's an error. Like there's a runtime error, or there's a because it type checks, right? Like
right.
I've never pulled it down and tried to load it in and have it totally break. And that's been a frustration I've had with the little work I've been doing with PureScript. They're working on that, trying to figure it out right now, but Elm has done an incredible job with that. And so, and on the JavaScript side too, I mean, you've got Yarn has done a lot in the recent months to help that out. But before that, I mean, every few months it was like, all right, forget whatever other tickets we had today at the company, everybody, we're going to work on fixing our node modules because someone updated something like 10 levels down and broke it all for us. So, it's like obligatory stop work and fix the build. And so I think that's great because that's never going to happen with Elm.
Yeah.
I also, you know, you kind of touched on something there that is another sort of surprising theme that I've found, which is that there's a pretty surprising degree of consistency about quality. Like, it's not 100%. It's not like every single library out there is just, you know, perfectly amazing. But it's kind of like I've come to expect that if I'm using a new Elm library, it's going to be sweet. Like, it's just going to be pretty, like, high quality and nicely designed and have, like, documentation. And, you know, and I've been pretty rarely surprised about that. Whereas when I did a lot of JavaScript, I felt like I did a ton of time. Like, I spent a ton of time just, like, shopping. Just like looking at different libraries that all solved approximately the same problem and trying to like divine and like look into the future and guess which one of them was going to be the most or least painful. And I just have all these heuristics about like GitHub stars and like reputation of authors and like just like maybe I'd look at some of the source code and just kind of like trying to figure out like, is this going to be nice or not?
Unanswered issues, pull requests that never got any response.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we've all been there, right? But with Elm, I'm just kind of like, oh, this library exists? Yeah, I'll give it a try. And so far, I mean, you know, maybe it's just that Elm is, you know, relatively young compared to JavaScript. And maybe if Elm ever gets to JavaScript scale, which, you know, I mean, what language will? But, you know, maybe in that imaginary future, maybe this isn't true anymore. But at least today, it's definitely a selling point for me.
I think we've found some of the fun we've had with Elm has been recognizing that in many cases, defining what a sweet library looks like has yet to be fully defined. I think you go into Elm and one of the questions you have until you do it is how will you create reusable pieces of UI? And when we had to do that for the first time, there were a lot of unanswered questions and a lot of, you know, when we have the question, how do we do this? The answer was often, oh, I don't know, try some things. There are a few options out there. The example I can think of, and this dates back to episode 2 of this podcast, Murphy, I think that's my favorite episode so far, which was updating in Elm.
Oh, and that's funny that that's your favorite. I like that.
Yeah, and particularly the discussion of if you've got a UI module that has its own view, its own update, its own init, and its own messages, and it maintains its own state, how do you get stuff out of that? So when your parent, your app, for example, calls the update of the nested module, and that module does something to its state that might be of interest to the consuming app, how do you get that information out of that nested module? And I think I've seen at least 3 different ways of cracking that nut. And some of them are objectively bad ideas. Some of them are objectively superior. But I don't think, at least for me as a relatively new Elm developer, I don't think I've seen the canonical, this is how it should always be done answer to that question. I can give you the example of the date picker library. And this is the one that was discussed on that episode, if I'm not mistaken. And they do a really interesting thing where the update function for the date picker returns, instead of a 2-tuple, a 3-tuple. And the third field in that tuple is a date value. And it is only populated if the date has changed as a result of the message that was sent to the update. And so when you call its update method, it kind of tells you back as a pseudo return value, did something change that might be of interest to the consuming app? And that kind of blew my mind that not all update functions have to return a tuple with 2 values in them. You can change that pattern if it makes sense to do so. And at the time when we discovered that, we had just built our own internal reusable module for the first time. And what we were doing is every time we sent it a message after the update had returned, we were then calling another function to pull the value out of the internal state of that module and see if it had changed. And not only does that create a whole bunch of extra code thrashing as all of those messages are going by, I think we only did it because we were doggedly following what we thought was an established pattern. But I think what's inspiring about Elm is because it's so young, people are still discovering useful patterns like this one.
And I think this loops back to your talk about the refactoring too, because one of the powers that Elm gives you is the power to do things wrong and not have it be a crippling blow.
Yeah.
I mean, it may take a couple of days of painfully rewriting code if you've gone down the wrong path, right? But the fact that the compiler is there to help you is huge. I spent at my previous company quite a bit of time trying to recover from design mistakes we made early on. I mean, like architectural design mistakes. And it was really stressful for me. Like it wasn't just, oh, this sucks. It was like actually stressful in my life, affecting it negatively, because I had to figure out all of the places in the code where this thing was affecting stuff, where it had to change. And I knew that there was no way for me to figure out where it was except like remembering, searching, and having the app crash. And that was it. And it was really stressful for my life. But here it's like, okay, so you followed that pattern and found a better way. And now you're free to refactor without all of that stress, which is pretty incredible, right?
This is a pattern that's been repeating for us, that we'll build it a way that works, and then we'll futz with it a bit, and suddenly half the code goes away, and it's still doing the same job.
Yeah.
And when that happens, you're like, okay, I think we found the right way to do this.
It's like, Elm, do it wrong so that it works, and then do it right so that it works.
Yeah. Maybe the most recent example, we had to display kind of modal dialogues on top of the screen. And on a given page, there could be one of three modal dialogues open at any time. And so what we initially did was that the surrounding app would, it would initialize the states of all three modal dialogues and mark the currently displayed dialog as nothing. And then when the app needed to open one of those dialogues, it would swap in the state of the dialogue it wanted to display until the dialogue produced a message that we could infer meant we now want to close that dialogue, and we set it back to nothing. But the internal state of that dialogue persisted, so that the next time we wanted to show it, we had to manually reset it and clear it out.
Nice.
And we were, this is, again, just one of those things where we're like, it's working. We know there are no bugs because of the compiler, but we're not happy with it. And then what we realized was that what we can do is let the dialogue itself know when it's been closed and return nothing from its update function. And so when the dialogue goes away, it just says, oh, and my state now is nothing. And if you want this dialogue again, just initialize a new one. And that's one of those things that when we did it, half the code went away and we went, yay, we won.
I actually like that. Go ahead, Richard, and I'll go after you.
So this might sound weird, but I kind of feel like that experience is sort of suggests like one of the right things to focus on in Elm, which is, and I'm going to articulate this the way that it makes sense in my head, but I admit I have not put a lot of thought into it, so maybe it's not going to make any sense to people. But basically what I'm thinking is sort of like, I kind of feel like patterns in Elm are often sort of the wrong way to think about things. And what I mean by that is that you mentioned earlier about the example of the date picker, where you wanted to, it was sort of internally encapsulating its own state, and that was like the right design because of how it was going to be reused. But you sort of needed to sort of send some information out based on its internal state. And what's interesting to me about that is basically, so you said like one of the ways that you found out about it was that what if you have its update return not just model and command, but also this extra piece of information, like the, make it a three tuple instead of two. And to me, what's interesting about that is not the idea of this is a new pattern, but rather that it's a good goal to get to the point where that's not interesting anymore, where you're just like, oh, I need to return some information. So like, this is a function. I'm just going to have it return the information.
Yeah.
That's it. Right. And so something that I do is like when we write reusable stateful things in our Elm code, I don't think about it as like, oh, this is going to return model and command, and then I'll use command.map and I'm just going to follow this recipe. I just think about like, well, what does this need to do? Right. And so like, if it doesn't actually need any state, I'll just be like, oh, I'll just write a view function. And actually, before I'll use the command.map route, usually I'll say, well, maybe I'll just make it a higher order view function. So like, it's a view function that takes a function that takes some piece of data and returns a message. So it's like the caller, you know, so I don't think about it in terms of like parent-child. I think that's like a very React idea. Mm. I think of it more as just like caller and function, right? So it's like the caller, I want them to pass me this function that tells me how to make messages that they understand. Like, that's like very straightforward, and it works really well if you only have like, you know, 1 to 3 messages.
Yeah.
As soon as you start getting like, you know, there are potentially 8 different messages that this thing can do. Well, then it's like, okay, I don't want to pass like a record with 8 fields in it every single time I'm calling this view function. That's just like really annoying. So at that point, it becomes less annoying to switch to command.map. And so I think what's interesting about this observation is just that if you go about writing things that way, then when you're using command.map, it's always because it's solving a problem for you, right? It's like, I could have passed this a huge record of all of these functions that produce messages, but that would have sucked. So command.map is like less annoying than that. And the only reason I was even thinking about passing it these messages was because there was some state that I needed to hold. Like I couldn't get out of that. There's no way like, well, I could have it like, so I could set up state management or not. It's like, no, I needed that. And then, so sometimes I see like in Elm Slack, you know, beginners saying like, hey, I've got all this boilerplate around commands. It's like so much boilerplate. But to me, what that suggests is that basically what you're doing is you're following a pattern that's leading to this boilerplate. Like if you're using command.map, you know, the way it's intended to be used, it's always solving a problem. It's always making your life easier because there was a more straightforward thing you could have done, but the more straightforward way was like annoyingly verbose, and command.map would make it less verbose.
Yeah.
And so basically it's like if you find that command.map is creating boilerplate for you, what that means is that like following this pattern has sort of led you astray. Like it's led you to a bad place. And like the solution is not to be like, well, how do I find a new pattern that's less boilerplate-y? The solution is like, well, just like, don't think about it in terms of these patterns. Think about it more in terms of like strategies for scaling, strategies for, you know, writing code in a way where you're sort of doing the minimum, most straightforward thing right up to the point where that gets annoying, and then you reach for a tool that solves that problem.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that happens pretty easily with, well, maybe not easily, but I think the way that develops naturally is with familiarity with the language. Because I found that as I use functional languages more, there are actually kind of design patterns that follow the design of functional languages. Because once you get to a functional language, whether it's Scala or whether it's Haskell or whether it's Elm or OCaml, like in any number of these languages, you have these concepts of partial application or currying, higher order functions, ADTs, and switching on ADT cases and things like that. Like there are all these like they're not so much design patterns as algorithms, but they're structural patterns, right? And so once you become comfortable with those things and you understand that the update function isn't magic, then you go, oh, it's just a function. Well, I'll just add another thing on here. But it takes getting used to functions first, because coming from the Python world or the JavaScript is weird, so we won't include that. But like Python
in our
C++
case, we're
world,
coming largely from the Ruby world. And so, yeah, learning these what makes sense in functional, what's a crazy idea, and what's just, oh, yeah, we're doing that thing.
Yeah, so I guess what I mean about like patterns is more about like sort of design patterns when it comes to architecture, as opposed to just sort of like understanding just functional techniques. So I guess what I'm getting at is sort of one way to look at the idea of this date picker returning a third, like a 3-tuple instead of a 2-tuple, is that, oh, this is an architectural pattern. I've heard people refer to that as out message, right? Mm. But I don't refer to it as that, because what I think about this as is like, the better way to teach people is sort of like the, you know, like to teach you to fish rather than, you know, giving you the fish, is to be like, recognize that this is an option that's available to you. So not only can you have it return a 3-tuple, but it's also perfectly fine to have it return a 2-tuple where it's eschewing command, right? So that's another thing that I try to do is like, if I'm making a reusable stateful thing, if it doesn't need to run any commands, I don't have it return command, because that tells me things about it, right? I'm like, this thing is actually more harmless. It's not capable of running HTTP. It's not capable of, you know, doing all the things that a command requires. Like I would just give it the minimal, you know, amount of stuff that it can work with that it needs to do its job. So maybe it's not that you're adding a third, you know, piece to that tuple. Maybe it's you want a 2-tuple, but in fact, it's a model and it's something else.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's like just one thing, right? Maybe it's or maybe you want to do a record instead of a tuple. The point is that architecturally speaking, you don't need to put your ideas into these boxes of saying like, oh, like you have model view and update and they're called that and they call each other. I think the more important idea is sort of thinking in terms of I started off with one model, one view, and one update, and then I ran into a problem. Like I was like, I need to do this thing. How do I do this thing? And sort of developing your toolbox of like ways to understand how functions can fit together and what the properties are of using functions in various different ways, such that the idea of adding a third thing to that tuple becomes very boring to you, where you're not like, whoa, that's mind-blowing. You're like, oh, yeah, right, sure.
I think this may be a fundamental difference between the world of JavaScript and the world of Elm that has to do with constraint. I think in this case, constraint can be the mother of invention. When you're working in such a constrained and focused language and environment such as Elm, then anything that's possible is probably worth trying. Whereas in a world like of JavaScript, where the range of the possible, the things that you can make the language do, is nearly infinite, and 99.9% of that possibility space is a horrible idea. And in that world, you kind of have to learn the rules before you start breaking them.
That is such a great point. I mean, especially because the consequences if you make a mistake are so much higher in JavaScript. Like so you made a great point earlier about like refactoring and how and like what that does to your development process. Like if you're able to refactor with confidence like you are in Elm, that really changes some fundamental things that are sort of non-obvious when you're getting into it. And this is, I think, one of them where you're sort of like, okay, in JavaScript, like even stuff like your file structure is kind of a big deal to get right early on. Right. Like if you so that's something people ask me in Elm where they're like, hey, what like how should I structure my files? I'm like, I don't think it's like that important. I don't know. Like just like put stuff in files. Like, yeah, it's like if you don't like it later, just like change it. Right.
Yeah.
But you have to like, you know, compare that with the typical experience in JavaScript where it's like if you change a bunch of file structure and move a bunch of stuff around between files, who knows what bugs you just introduced. Right. Also, you're probably gonna have to rewrite a bunch of tests. Like one of the things that sort of goes unsaid, like people sometimes will say in Elm you have to write fewer tests to get the same confidence about your code because the compiler picks up a lot of slack for you. But what goes unsaid there is that not only is that true, but it's also true that when you refactor your code, the compiler still redoes all those tests for you, right? The stuff that you would have had to write tests by hand for in JavaScript, when you refactor, you also have to change your tests, right? Like however many tests you've got, if you refactor such that those tests no longer run, it's your responsibility to go update those tests by hand. Whereas the stuff that Elm's compiler catches for you, post-refactor, again, the compiler is doing that for you for free. So every single time you perform a refactor, you're getting that cost savings every single time.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I want to jump us over really quick to another topic, specifically regarding Elm in production. And we didn't even get to talk, Richard, about how you and I got it at the company, at our company. That's because this is such a fun topic to talk about. But let's go ahead and jump over to actually running in production and what kind of considerations you have taken, Richard and Kevin, at your companies for like maintaining a front end app. I mean, do you have like Sentry running? I mean, I know there aren't supposed to be runtime exceptions, but sometimes you can do evil things in your code and expect it. Or like, are you doing monitoring? What kind of considerations have you put into making sure that your front end is, that your Elm part of your front end is doing what it should be doing?
So we do like, you know, a pretty decent amount of JavaScript interop. So I think that's going to be true of most people. Like, you know, the JavaScript ecosystem is way bigger than Elm's ecosystem. And I think interop is going to be normal for a long time. There's like different degrees of it, right, obviously. But, basically, JavaScript interop means that you're running JavaScript code and it can crash. I mean, Elm code, of course, can crash, right? Like we've been in production for about a year and a half, and we still have not gotten our first runtime exception from Elm code. But the reason we know that is that we run Rollbar and it tracks our exceptions. So we do see all of the exceptions from our JavaScript code. It's just that when we see one and we go to fix it, the fix is always changing JavaScript code. It still has not ever been changing a line of Elm code. I'm actually kind of curious to hear if you've you've had a similar experience, Kevin.
We have. In the brown bag I ran earlier this week, one of the questions I got was, does Elm produce source maps so that you can debug issues in the browser? And the three of us on the team who've been working in Elm kind of looked at each other and said, You know what? I vaguely remember checking that source maps were working on the day we set up Elm, and we haven't used them in all of the months that we've been using Elm.
Really, I don't think Elm has source maps.
No?
As far as I know.
You're making a liar.
Yeah,
out
I don't
me.
Think so.
No, I mean, well, that's the thing, right? Is it's like, how would you know? Like, yeah. I mean, so have you guys gotten any production runtime exceptions yet?
No, definitely not. We haven't. We our Elm is a small sea of sanity in a large ocean of JavaScript at the moment as well. And so we certainly get issues at the borders and around the place. But basically, if the Elm compiles and passes basic QA testing, as in the feature works, we don't see anything in production that surprises us.
I'm still just waiting for like the day. Like, we've actually had conversations about this because at this point it's been so long where it's just like sooner or later somebody's bound to write something that just like recurses indefinitely and just causes a Stack Overflow, right? Like, I mean, there's like ways to get runtime exceptions out of Elm code.
I'll tell you what we have seen. We've seen issues in CI occasionally, and I think it is related to the fact that we're building our Elm using the Webpack loader.
Oh yeah, us too.
So the way we're compiling our Elm in that environment, I think, might be a little fragile. Just the way the package manager gets called on demand as part of our Webpack build, we've occasionally seen weird errors where then the test suite is unable to load some core part of Elm. It seems from the error that some core part of Elm has gone missing. And we have yet to drill into the big JavaScript bundle to see what exactly happened as part of the build. But where we've seen fragility, it's been at that point in the chain.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. I have not been happy with Webpack. And I don't know if it's, you know, like... I guess I hear mixed things about Webpack in general, but when we decided to migrate to Webpack, it was sort of a this is a popular tool, so we just expect a certain level of, you know, it just works, even though we kind of heard that it's, it can be a pain to configure at first. But we didn't expect for things like seg faults, you know, and issues like that. I mean, we haven't gotten that particular issue, but we've gotten a lot of other issues. And my coworker, Noah, he's like spent a lot of time just contributing to that Webpack loader and just like trying to, you know, make stuff more reliable.
I've been rolling up my sleeves and reading through that code as well. I had the unfortunate experience this past week of spending all day on a pull request, submitting it. And then when I saw my pull request on GitHub, I saw that there was an existing pull request 9 days old right next to it that fixed the same problem. And I kind of, you know,
been there.
It's pretty crazy to me. So like, I maintain Elm CSS, right? Which is like a pretty ambitious project. It's like add like type safe CSS in another language, you know, like CSS is not small. And like the volume of pull requests that go into that versus the Webpack loader is like way smaller. And like that just seems off to me. It just seems like building, you know, in a sane way is sort of like, isn't that kind of the whole point of the tool is just to be, you know, like to make this stuff easy. And anyway, I'm ranting, but
no, Richard, the reason is because your library is so perfect that nobody has improvements to make.
Obviously you have not read the source code to that library because
this is an interesting area for us, how we're doing CSS, because like I said, we are a small team within a bigger company that is still pretty much on the React bandwagon. Much of our CSS of our greater app is written in CSS modules that are imported then by React components. And we kind of had the choice when we started dabbling with Elm to either start building our own CSS in Elm CSS or find some way to integrate and reuse those styles from the React components that are in use at the rest of the company. And I think it's been swimming upstream for us a bit, but we have so far stuck with writing our CSS as CSS modules and then passing in the class names as flags to our Elm app. It's been a bit hairy because basically your top level app needs to know about every CSS module that any descendant module in Elm is going to need and needs to ask for it at the top and decode all of those and then pass down the subsets of styles to the child components. I keep trying to avoid the word component because it's often not the right way to think about it. But yeah, we've gone down that road. It's working okay for us so far, but it feels like we are fighting. You know, it's that same feeling that you often get with Elm, that you've built a thing that works, but you have yet to find the perfect solution.
I want to avoid going on a tangent because this is like obviously a topic I talk about a lot, but like about the component thing. So it's funny to me because I think I saw a post on Reddit a while ago, like on the Elm subreddit, about like someone saying like, "Hey, I don't want to say the C word." And I'm like, "Oh man," like it's like the point that like I try to make and that Evan tries to make about components is that like it's a different paradigm to have like sort of a component oriented architecture. So like if you go to the React homepage, it's like, and like front and center, one of the big like selling points that it says is like component based, and it says build encapsulated components that manage their own state, then compose them to make complex UIs. And I have never heard a more succinct way to describe what you should exactly not do in Elm. Right? It's like that is exactly the wrong way to scale Elm applications. For React applications, it's like kind of clear that that's the way it's designed, right? But the point is that that's not how Elm is designed. You should not be thinking about how do I encapsulate state in different parts of my application. It's more that encapsulated state is a tool that you use when that's the only solution that will work, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's like, I need to reuse something that has its own state, or like a modal is the only non-reusable example, like or like for single page applications, like when you have different logical pages. Mm. Those are the only three use cases I've ever encountered where that technique makes sense, where you have like local encapsulated state. And it's because if you don't have that, like it's sort of like not possible to do what you're trying to do. But, you know, just sort of reaching for it as like this is the way to scale, I think is, you know, clearly what React is designed for and also not what Elm is designed for. So when I say like let's not talk about in terms of components, what I'm trying to say is that Elm doesn't have a component system on purpose because that's not how it's designed. And so when you're talking about here are my Elm components, what you're kind of saying is like I want to speak about Elm in React terms, and that just inevitably leads to confusion. So I'll get off my soapbox about it, but it's not the word. It's about the concept. It's about the, you know, like what is Elm designed for?
Yeah.
Well, guess anyway, what? It's pick time.
I do want to say one thing about CSS real quick. That's super interesting. I haven't heard anyone using CSS modules with Elm, but we have been using SAS like just plain old SAS for a long time, and we've actually started using Elm CSS, and now we're using Elm CSS in production. It's been pretty sweet, but I would like to figure out a way to get something like CSS modules with like the hashes and the class names in there, but it's kind of a big project, so probably not anytime soon.
The thing that we need it for is that we're a big enough company with teams working in parallel that we're now at that breaking point where we need to be able to create a team who can be a caretaker of the consistency of the user experience. And totally. They need some way to express that, to say, this is what a button looks like. This is what standard margins are between two boxes in our UI. And if we need to implement everything twice, once for Elm and once for React, then myself as a tech lead, I'm going to have a real hard time justifying that extra expenditure of energy.
Yeah, I totally get that. And we only started switching over when it became like Elm was the majority of our code base. So like the pages that were going to need that consistency were already all in Elm. But I totally get when
that,
you,
yeah,
like until that point, it just doesn't make sense.
Yep.
All right, now it's pick time. But I think that this has been a really cool conversation, and we didn't even get to part of what I wanted to talk about. So I'm sure there'll be, you know, two or three more versions of this episode too as we move along.
You'll have to, you know, keep going with it. Yeah.
In fact, maybe we should just have this be a recurring topic, like every quarter or something. Just to
I think how Elm works at real companies. That's in some ways the core question for the Elm community to answer at the moment.
Yeah, that's a great point.
I was fascinated to hear your story because it parallels ours a lot. Like if anyone's looking for our story, like as Murphy alluded to, I've told it in various public fora, most recently at ReactiveConf in Bratislava. So if you just search for Elm and React in production, you can just sort of find that talk, and then I give the same kind of a story.
you said at the start, Richard, that No Red Ink is hiring. I want to make the point that CultureAmp also is hiring. Certainly, if you're in Melbourne or anywhere in Australia and you are interested in working on a real LMAP that's in production, I am dying to hear from you. Even if you can't leave where you're working, if you're happy where you're working, if you can't move to Melbourne, I would just like to hear from people who are in Australia who are turned on by that idea. Because that's the question I have to answer is, I think we've proven that Elm is a technical asset. Can it be an asset as we as a company need to scale and grow our size? Is it a language that people who have been writing JavaScript for 10 years will be interested in switching to? Or are we going to be constrained to only hiring functional programmers who may not have that great a passion of the browser as a runtime environment?
Elm has been the biggest source of candidates for us. And actually, we don't remember how we ever managed to hire anyone before Elm because it blows everything else out of the water. So I think you're doing the right thing. Just go on podcasts. Just make sure that people know that you're using Elm in production and see what happens.
That's exciting for me to hear.
Yeah, keep us in touch. Keep in touch with us, Kevin, because we want to hear and talk about it on the show too. So as you go through that hiring journey, let us know how that feels. Pick time. Kevin, will you start out with your picks, please?
Woo! I have 5 picks.
That's a great number of picks.
The first is a tip, and it is the Elm search, which, I have it built into my launcher now. But it is a site called Elm Search that, on the surface, it seems like you can use it to search for Elm packages. But the tricky thing is, if you put a type signature into the search box on the Elm search site, it will find for you every function in every package in the package index that satisfies that type signature. So if you know that you are looking for, and this is really especially useful for beginners who don't know their way around the common libraries out there, if you know what you need is a function that takes a list of things and returns a Boolean, you can just put list A arrow Boolean and it will show you every function in every library that's out there that has that type signature. And right away you can pick out, oh, there's that function that I need and that's what library it's in and I can add that to my package file. This deep search inside of the libraries available, that's my first pick as a tip.
Great pick.
The next one is perhaps more of a plug than a pick, but I'm a big fan of Sublime Text. I'm actually looking to contribute to the Sublime Text support package for the Elm language in Sublime. And apart from contributing packages to the Sublime Text ecosystem, recently I recorded a new edition of my lynda.com course on Sublime Text. It's called Learn Sublime Text 3, The Basics, and it's just 2 weeks old right now. So Sublime Text has been around for a while. There is a lot of old advice about Sublime and its features and how to use them out there. This is a sparkling fresh look at this piece of software. It's about an hour and 20 minutes long. And so if you've got a lynda.com subscription, you can check it out right away. And I've got kind of a meta pick, which is if you don't have a lynda.com subscription, the chances are very good that your local public library has a lynda.com subscription. And I don't know how many of us as digital people have visited our local public library lately, but this is a good reason to do it because you can show up, get a library card, and then immediately get a personal password for lynda.com for free. Our tax dollars at work.
Wow.
And then you have complete free access to the lynda.com video tutorial library, which those who know it will know it's the biggest library of its kind. It's been around for years and years. And if there's a piece of software out there, whether for design, photography, development, whatever, chances are there's a really high quality lynda.com course available for it. So that's my meta pick is get to your local library and get yourself free access to lynda.com and feel better about paying your taxes every year.
That's great.
My next pick is Prettier, which this goes back to something we were talking about earlier with Elm Format. It's a live formatter for JavaScript. It's brand new. It supports brand new language features in ES 2017. It supports JSX. It supports Flow if you're doing types in your JavaScript. So if you've like us, become hooked on Elm format and want to get that same experience in other languages. Prettier is brand new. It was released just at the start of January. It's written by a fellow named James Long, who has just left Mozilla, had some spare time on his hands, and decided to write this as his New Year's resolution. So take advantage. I'm going to see if I can convince the team at CultureAmp to give up on its ESLint rules and switch to Prettier so that we can benefit from that auto-formatting experience that we've been talking about. I'd like to plug the Elm tutorial, which is by a guy named Sebastian Porto. He's a local. He's here in Melbourne with me, and he co-runs the local Elm meetup. It's at elm-tutorial.org. He's written a great big tutorial. It's a lot like the official Elm tutorial that you'll get on the Elm website that Evan has written. It's in the same sort of format, but it picks up where that language tutorial leaves off and goes into how do you build a single page app. And it covers things like setting up Webpack to build your Elm and doing things like fetching and routing. And really, it kind of takes the pure skills of Elm. And I think if my experience is anywhere to go by, you get to the end of that official Elm tutorial and you're all excited by the language, but you're really at sea in terms of how do I build something real with this? I would say this tutorial proposes a lot of patterns, and we've talked about patterns on this episode and how there are pros and cons to them. I would say, as a beginner who just wanted something to hang my hat on, to see something real built, it was really useful. The more I mature into my experience with Elm, the more I look at some of the things in this tutorial and go, oh, well, that's one way to do it. And I can think of other ways to do it that might be equally valid under other conditions. So I won't say it's the be-all and end-all of follow this blueprint for building single page apps in Elm, but I will say it is an amazing sort of icebreaker if you're starting on that journey and you're really kind of feeling lost at sea.
Awesome.
Just a quick note on that. I wish Sebastian would take out the section on how to do Elm components, because I kind of think it's confusing a lot of people, but you know, neither here nor there.
My last pick has nothing to do with Elm. But hopefully I'm not the only Star Trek fan listening. And 2016 was the 50-year anniversary of Star Trek, which means all manner of memorabilia and DVD box set came out in the past year. And I put my money into way too many of them. And I want to pick just one as the thing that I felt was worth my time and investment as a Star Trek fan. And that's a book called The 50-Year Mission. And in fact, it's two books. Two volumes. The first one's the first 25 years, and the second one is the next 25 years. And it's a complete uncensored oral history of Star Trek. And it's snippets of interviews from the writers, the production staff, the cast, from the very beginning right to the end of the very latest movie. And I heard so many stories that, as a rabid Star Trek fan, were brand new to me. And I say heard because I listened to this book on audible.com. So another meta pick is if reading 1,000 pages on Star Trek sounds like fun but not something you have time for, maybe pick up the audiobook version. It's really great. It's a full cast recording, so they've got actors impersonating the various people who were interviewed book, and it's a really great listen.
Way to have some awesome picks. Love it. And also, I love Star Trek too. All right, Richard, you're up next.
All right, I've got three picks. So the first one is a talk by Andrea Stefik. It's called Evidence-Oriented Programming. And with the title, you might be wondering what that is all about. Is it like a way that you can write code? But what's actually the subject of the talk is actually about usability in programming languages from the perspective of actual academic studies on what's most usable. So he has this great phrase of like, we've been in sort of the astrology age of programming language usability, where there's sort of like lots of people making claims that are not actually based on scientific evidence. So there's actually things about like, what's more usable, camel case or snake case? And there are actually studies that they've run and like comparing them in different metrics to see like, are people more efficient in one or the other? About type systems, about, you know, all sorts of different things. And this talk is just sort of like an introduction to sort of like what's out there, because this is what he does his research on. Really fascinating stuff. So that's pick number one. Pick number two, and this is a first for me, but I'm going to post a pic of something that I have not actually consumed myself. But that's because I haven't had time to. So last night was the San Francisco Elm meetup, and we were having a discussion in which Evan, because he's actually a coworker of mine now, we hired him, but he was talking about this book that he'd been reading that was fascinating, and it's called Public Opinion by Walter Lippmann. And it's this book from like 1922. It's like in the public domain. I'm going to link to the Wikipedia page because you can just read the whole text online for free. But basically, even though it's almost a century old, apparently, according to Evan, the stuff that this guy talks about like how media shapes influence and like, you know, about how people like kind of like how the world works still apply today post-internet. Which is just kind of mind-blowing to me that someone could be that prescient that long ago about things that just, like, ring true on so many levels today. So I have not read it yet because I just found out it existed yesterday, but I'm pretty excited about it. It's, like, kind of been on my mind. So that's pick number two. And pick number three is, so I guess a lot of people know that I'm writing Elm in Action for Manning Publications, but I think not as many people know that I did a two-day front-end master's Elm workshop for basically just kind of going from zero Elm knowledge all the way up through, like, you have now done HTTP and JavaScript interop and kind of the testing, just like pretty much all of the basic stuff you'd need to like launch an actual Elm application into production. And so I spent a huge amount of time on that, over 100 hours of like live classroom teaching, just kind of preparing for that. And so hopefully the results are worth it. But now they've got a video up. It's not edited yet, but I guess it's going to be edited very soon. But you can at least watch the recording, even unedited in a sort of raw form on the Frontend Masters website.
Nice, Richard. Thank you for sharing those things. I get to do the picks now. Ha ha ha. And my first pick is the Ergo Chair from the company called Autonomous. And this is a pretty neat chair. I am sitting in it right now, and I like it a lot. And I've been kind of a chair nerd for the past couple of years. I have a Hag Capisco chair at work that I love. It's the less expensive model. It's the one you only have to sell your car for and not your house. But I wanted to get my wife a good chair for home, and one of my coworkers got this Ergo chair from Autonomous. And my friends, I'm telling you, this is comfort for $200. No joke. I know, right?
Whoa.
Isn't that incredible? It's cost the same as an IKEA office chair, and it is this is one of the best chairs that I've sat in. So I'm gonna pick that because love it. And let's see, next is, okay, so I actually also just started my master's degree this week. Thank you.
Congratulations.
I've been pretty busy already. It's a lot of work, but I started it with Georgia Tech. They have an online master's degree, but it's not the kind of online master's degree that you hear when people say like, oh yeah, I'll go to an online thing. I could pay $50. And I go, no, this is actually full-blown Georgia Tech master's degree. At the end of it, you get a diploma that says you got your master's degree in CS from Georgia Tech, and it doesn't say online anywhere on it. And you can like fly there and go through the convocation with everyone. So it's legitimate. Yeah,
nice.
They're doing some really neat stuff. So what they've done is they've put all of their lessons online in recorded formats with Udacity, and then they have their professors and their TAs work with you. So you pay them money, and you go and, well, you have to get accepted too. There's a kind of rigorous application process. I don't know about rigorous, but I mean, because I was able to get in, so you know, it's not that rigorous. But thanks.
Let's let yourself short.
But I mean, I do want to encourage whomever is interested in this, because I don't have a computer science undergraduate degree. My undergraduate degree is in animation. But I was able to write to them and say, you know, I do this professionally, so I'm comfortable with it, and get some letters of recommendation and stuff. And they let me in when I think other universities would have turned me away because of my background. So I've been enjoying it quite a bit. So they've got the courses online, and you interact with real people and other students, and you interact with real professors and TAs, and you get all that feedback. So it's been really exciting already. I'm taking my first course on knowledge-based artificial intelligence. So that's really fun. And I recommend anyone who is looking to further their education post-undergraduate degree and doesn't know how, this is a program that's designed to be possible to do while you're working full-time. And they're okay with that. And it's also cost-wise, many people will be able to pay for it out of their own pocket without having to go into student debt or anything like that. So it's kind of a revolution in education as far as I'm concerned, and I'm enjoying it. So come do it with me.
Murphy, as a listener, I was a little worried the other day when you mentioned that you were taking this on. I was a little worried about what it might mean to the podcast. So I'm relieved to hear it's meant to fit in with the rest of your life.
Let's hope that it all does. My second baby is also due in 6 weeks. So things might get a little bit hairy.
Good luck.
Luckily, we're recording this show a few weeks before it'll be released. So maybe I'll take a bye once baby gets born. That would be a good idea. I think my wife would appreciate it.
Did you just say your baby was going to be released?
Yeah, I think so. My baby's in a couple of weeks.
It's like our RC1 at this point.
And you know,
but
it's going to get pushed back like a year.
We'll see.
So we're going to be fun.
No errors in production. That's what I want.
All right. So last pick is Elm Jutsu, which is a super awesome plugin for Atom, written by...
Yeah.
I wrote his name down because I never remember his name. By Irvin Ola, my buddy on Slack, whose name is Halo Special there. And I don't know how to pronounce his Twitter name, but this is a fantastic plugin. And he has been doing all kinds of crazy cool work here, just like in his spare time. He always pings me and he's like, oh, yeah, I'm up with my baby again. It's like 2 a.m. and so I'm working on Elm Jutsu. And I'm like, yeah, baby, keep waking up because he keeps doing awesome stuff. So just recently he added auto imports, which is something I was dying for, and a number of other awesome things like code generation for if you type case something of, and you can then autocomplete and it'll generate those branches for that case for you. And there's a bunch of other generation too. And then there's this really weird but also cool thing that he snuck in that he was like, I don't know if this is useful, but I did it. There's a mode where you can select text in your editor and then pop open a mini editor at the bottom of the window, and you actually have access to run Elm on that piece of text. So, for example, if you highlight a string with words in it, right? And then down there at the bottom, you could type string.split space, and boom, in your editor, all the spaces will be removed and all of those things will become multiple lines. And then he does like string.map and then some string transformation to it. Like to capitalize the first letter, maybe string.map, capitalize first. Every line it goes through, it capitalizes the first letter. It's really cool. I haven't used it yet, but it is super cool to watch the GIF. And I go, whoa, this is going to be so helpful when I'm editing like tons of things that I have to edit. So that's, I don't know. It doesn't really like necessarily fit into the Elm tooling. It's just awesome that you can run those things on your lines. So go have fun with that. That's my last pick.
It takes a special person to be so passionate about Elm, the language that lets you write less JavaScript, to go and write a bunch of JavaScript plugins for an editor to make the experience of writing Elm better.
You know what's cool?
I got to applaud that.
He is actually, most of Elm Jutsu is implemented in Elm, using ports and doing a lot of the code that he does is in Elm, which is pretty sweet.
That's how I've done it with Elm tests too. It's just like, you know, technically Elm is not designed to run on Node, but it's like, if most of what you're writing is business logic, you can just do a couple of ports for the few things that you do need to use.
It gets a little heavy in the editor plugin case, but it's good. So thanks, Irvin, for all the hours that you spent, and we love it.
Yeah, I use it too. It's great.
All right. That's our show. Thank you, Richard and Kevin, so much for coming on. Thank you, dear listeners, for listening.
Thanks, Murphy.
You're welcome, Kevin. Bye-bye.
Bye.